Okay, thank you very much, John. I think as John mentioned, in my former life, I used to work in a small company, Autel Corporation, and it's a company that actually made fiber optic transmitter, specifically linear analog fiber optic transmitter that is being sold to the cable TV industry for installation of this so-called hybrid fiber coax network. So my previous work was really more in lasers, optoelectronic devices, and also transmission systems associated with those devices. And my venture into the subject that I am going to talk about today is actually a fairly recent occurrence. It happened just about, I would say, 2.5 years ago. Since I came to Berkeley, I of course become aware of the fact that Berkeley has a very substantial effort in the so-called the Berkeley Sensors and Actuation Center, that particular organization, which consists of about five faculty members and as well as 30 or 40 graduate students, has been quite instrumental in pushing forth the technology of so-called micromachining. Silicon micromachining, it has generated a lot of enthusiasm and fascination among many people on what these so-called silicon micromachines, what they are supposed to do, and what their potential are supposed to be. Now, for many years, this technology actually has, you can classify it as a technology looking for a solution, in the sense that you have discovered all these neat things that you can do with silicon processing and all these neat little motors that you can run around. And there are speculations that you can put these motors inside your body and they swim around and they will find all kinds of neat things. Those are, of course, speculations. For many years, just about the only, by no means minor though, applications of micromachining is in a very simple device, namely to use it as an accelerometer. Like a cantilever, a little cantilever, okay, and if you accelerate, you bend the lever, and you can sense acceleration using that very simple device. And that device is actually manufactured in a fairly large volume now, today, for your airbag, airbag applications in cars. And that is, of course, is a very simple micromachines device, very fundamental. But on the other hand, technology has developed in the meantime that allow you to build more and more complicated and fascinating devices that are looking for applications. When I came in and I see what kind of technologies are available, I see an opening in here in applying some of these more advanced features of micromachining towards photonic applications. And so we started this program, which we call Microphotonics. Since then it has grown from basically like a one person or two person effort into an effort which consists right now of about 8 to 9 graduate students and postdocs. And in fact, can I borrow a pen from you? So I can point. Okay, so these are the people that have been involved at one time or another in this project, and there are some new members which I have not listed. But the original motivation of this project is actually fairly simple and modest, from that sense. In that, this is a fiber optic packaged, high-speed fiber optic packaged laser transmitter, one that is built in my former company. And that's the fiber pigtail coming out, and this is a high-speed microwave signal going in, and you get all sorts of neat stuff in there, including a laser diode and amplifiers and so on. And if you look at what's inside, this is a rough schematic diagram of what goes on inside. And that's the fiber optic going out, and that's the electrical feed through going in, and this is the coaxial coplanar coaxial line. And the laser diode is actually sitting right there, that little dot in there, and that's where the fiber is sticking all the way up against, not quite touching, but very close to the laser diode. And all the rest of the stuff, these are the microstrip lines and all the microwave components and the electrical bias and so on and so forth, they are quite standard. So if you look at this package, this is an optoelectronic package. And what is different between this package and a standard microwave package, like an amplifier package? Well, everything is the same. There's only one difference, namely that there's this piece of optical fiber in there that you need to put in there that needs to be aligned to the laser and aligned to the accuracy of within a micron or two for single-mode fibers. And you need to align to that accuracy in order for you to couple the suitable amount of light into the fiber. And the device has been performed under certain specifications, and the optical coupling is one of the most important specifications of all. Now, for this kind of alignment, and every one of you who have worked with micropositioners in an optical lab knows that aligning to within a couple of microns is not a difficult thing. You just have to have a nice micropositioner, and you can move it around, and you can get there. Now, the difficult thing in a package like this is that not only do you need to get there, but you need to stay there. And you need to stay there for the duration of operation of the package, of the life of the package, basically, under all kinds of conditions, environmental conditions, temperature variations, shock, and so on. And that perhaps is the most difficult thing, is how do you make the fiber stay at a certain place and not move? And that, I would say, is the majority, constitute a fairly major part of the cost that you would pay for a fiber optic package or optoelectronic package like this. Alignment, optical alignment. And that is quite unique, that you do not find in a conventional microwave or electronic package. And the fact of the matter is that people are trying to desensitize that kind of alignment requirements just so that when things do move around a little bit, it doesn't affect the performance by too much. So there is this so-called passive silicon optical bench technology, which some of you might have heard of, that basically, this is in a manufacturing procedure. I don't want to align. I don't want to have somebody sit there and move around the fiber. And then I don't know what to do. Either you solder it or you epoxy it or hope that it won't move afterwards. So there's this silicon optical bench technology. It's a technology in which you try to put certain etched stops and etch into the silicon substrate and to produce certain physical stops and also certain solder bumps and certain contacts so that when you pop the device, lasers or fibers or whatever on there, there's some automatic alignment in there, so you don't have to really have to physically monitor everything when you are doing the packaging, which is the costly part. And that's the so-called silicon optical bench technology. And the accuracy, of course, is limited. You can only do plus or minus about a micron or so of accuracy before you can. Actually, there's a mistake in here, all of it. This is plus or minus, not 0.1, but 1 micron. Plus or minus 1 micron. So when you pop things down, you move around, and you accuracy is plus or minus 1 micron. And then the coupling efficiency, if you require a certain minimum coupling efficiency, this tells you how much yield. Okay, if you just pop down the devices in 100 package, how many of them come out to be within spec? And that is not exactly satisfactory. On the other hand, if you are allowed to actually physically move the fiber around, and actually obtain the optimal alignment, and even though the accuracy still is plus or minus 1 micron, you get a much better yield. And why is that? And the reason for that is that in any optical system, there are multiple components, lasers, lenses, fibers, and so on. And the accuracy requirement of every component is not the same. In other words, if you were to move the fiber by 1 micron, you might lose coupling by X%, but if you were to move the lens by 1 micron, you drop the coupling efficiency tremendously because there are various amplification factors involved in the different components. And if every component is positioned within plus or minus 1 micron, the result is that it's not very good. But on the other hand, if you pop down the components and basically allow afterwards to move one of the components, the most insensitive component around, to its optimal position, then you get a very good yield. And that is why in the existing fiber optic packaging, you would see people sitting around and rows of these things, and people would look under the microscope and grab fibers and move it around and monitor the output until you get to the optimal coupling point. And then you try to fix it there. And that is really costing you a lot of the cost which you would pay in buying this kind of package. So the idea here now is that can we eliminate that procedure but still retain the advantage of being able to move around components after, move around one insensitive component after all of them has been fixed down on the substrate. Now, like for example, if you were to fix the laser and fix the lens, okay, then, the fiber, you would have to put it in the right place in order for optimal coupling to be done. And this, you try to move around the fiber and try to fix it, at its optimal position, and that is difficult because fiber is a very stiff thing, first of all, and you try to fix it at a location, and hope that it doesn't move for the next 10 years. That's difficult, and it's labor intensive. So our concept is that, we would, pop down all these components and fix them in place. They are not exactly aligned, but we would use one micro mirror, using a micro machining technology to produce a micro mirror, which, is capable of moving around, by itself. And basically do the optimal alignment, that way, without the need for human hands. And there's an automatic, alignment system. There's a servo system that automatically align the laser to the required location, without any human intervention. So that is at least the, overall, concept of using these kind of micro machines, these very light, very small micromechanical components to do optimal alignment in a package, so you don't have to deal with it during the manufacturing process. And the basic component is what is shown here, that the laser, the lens, and the fiber. And what you see here is that this is like a slider that can slide back and forth, and this can slide back and forth, and between these plates are hinges. These can rotate, these are rotating hinges, and as you slide back and forth, these two sliders either jointly or independently, you can direct the beam onto any spot on the fiber, and hence produce alignment, optimal alignment. So this was one of the first devices that we built, and there are many variations that would come after that. But basically, what you see here is a silicon device, and these plates are built from polysilicon, and they are about 2 microns thick. And these are the hubs, and the slider are free to slide. The substrate is a silicon substrate, and these plates are polysilicon, and the polysilicon plates can slide back and forth freely on the surface of the silicon substrate, and the motion being confined by these hubs. Okay, and these are the micro hinges, and to look at the dimension, this is 100 micron, so this plate, this mirror itself, it's about a few hundred microns across. And these hinges themselves are only about 20 or some micron big. And the hinges are exactly like those that you would see in your door hinge, that it is of the so-called pin and staple type. There's a pin going through a staple. Great. So they can rotate. These plates are free to rotate, back and forth. And that is the primary mirror, and that is the back support structure. And as one of the things that need to be noted in here, in that the surface of this mirror obviously got to be of optical quality because we are using it as an optical component. And the fact of the matter is also is that we are propagating the light beam in the plane that is parallel to that of the substrate, and therefore the optical components, the optical surfaces, got to be perpendicular to the substrate. And it is in general very difficult to produce by etching or by any other technique a vertical surface that is so big, several hundred microns high, and yet have the vertical surface to be of optical quality, and to have the whole thing movable. So this is one technology that we adopt, for to solve that problem, namely that this surface, the way that you fabricate it, I will show some steps of fabrication later, but when it was first fabricated, everything is lying flat on the surface. So all these, all these surfaces are initially flat, which you can process with a high degree of uniformity, and it is after processing that we would pop up, this structure using this hinge technology. So that allows you to have a vertical surface of optical quality, and yet is movable, okay, and yet is also of the considerable size that is being shown here. Now you see certain holes in there, okay, those are the holes that are being used during the processing steps to release this structure from the surface, and they're actually not necessary. At least, you know, you don't need that many holes in there to produce the structure. You know, but you know, these are the initial structures, and it's there nonetheless. These holes are very small. They are like several microns thick, big, out of this whole surface, and it really does not affect the optical quality considerably. You know, but obviously, these holes are to be eliminated in later versions. Just some more pictures of the structure. That's the basic structure that that you may have seen, and these are the structures that is being propped up at the various stages at various angles. And there's a detailed blow up of the, this is a hinge, and as I said, it was of the pin and staple type. There's a pin going for a staple, so these plates can rotate freely against one another. And the dimensions is approximately, this is approximately 25 micron big. And the pins themselves are only a few microns across. Yeah, again, yet more pictures to see that these sliders are basically free to slide back and forth. And so this reflecting surface, the primary reflecting surface, can be directed at various angles by doing that. And this is actually a picture that shows very clearly the pin structure or the hinge structure. And this is the plate that connects to the pin that goes all the way across. That's the staple. And actually, the top of the staple was etched off for this particular device, so you can see the pin going through it. Okay, so these two plates can rotate against one another. A schematic of the so-called pin and staple structure. And each of these, the blue and the orange, they are both polysilicon plates, approximately 2 microns thick. And there's a clearance in the middle that goes all the way through it. And this orange plate is actually anchored to the surface of the silicon substrate. So this doesn't move. This and this can move, and it can rotate freely. Now, although the original intention for building this kind of a micromirror structure is that of easing the task of alignment from the laser to fiber in the optoelectronic package, once you develop this kind of technology, it's not difficult to imagine that you can now build more complicated functional optical systems using the flexibility that we have on the silicon structures. And for example, it can be used for beam steering optical alignment. We can do it for scanning, and I have an example of the scanning applications later on, which I will show. The switching, you can build inexpensive switches that way. And the systems that you can build, like laser-to-fiber couplers, which I've mentioned, external cavity lasers, those are the tunable external cavity lasers, continuously tunable external cavity lasers, fiber switches, interferometers, and so on. And as an example, this is actually something that we would plan to build, external cavity tunable laser. And these are the things that you can buy from Hewlett-Packard, for example, or other companies that involve a laser diode and then an external cavity grating. And this can be tuned, the wavelength can be tuned continuously by translating and rotating at the same time the grating at a prescribed, in a prescribed fashion. They have to be rotated and translated at the same time, in order for continuous tuning. And of course, you can imagine that this is the plate that I have just shown you. I can obviously put a grating on top of that plate. It can be done because during processing of that structure, everything is planar on the surface. I can put a grating on that particular mirror before I pop it up. And then certainly I can translate and rotate just based on the electronic control off-chip. So, which brings forth to the question that, how am I supposed to move these things? They are movable in the sense that, one is a sliding plate on top of the silicon surface, but how do I move them without having to stick my finger in it or stick something in it that physically push it around? So, actuation becomes an important issue in here now. And the requirements of the actuation is that for some of these applications, the plates need to be moved a considerable distance. Like, I need to move this plate by several hundred microns. And at the same time, throughout this motion, I want to maintain the accuracy of the motion to within a fraction of a micron. Okay. So I need to build a motor, you know, in a way, kind of like a stepping motor, that I can step, you know, and move these things with that kind of range and accuracy. And I'll show you. No, this is by no means the only way, but it is the way that we know how to do best, and we have developed this particular motor technology to a fairly high degree of sophistication, and it's called a vibromotor. And what it is that the operation principle is actually very simple. This is my slider, and it can slide back and forth freely. And how do I make it to slide? Well, if I just kick it once, it will move once. If I kick it in this direction, it will move one step in this direction. If I kick it back, it's the other way, it will move one step back in the, you know, in the other direction. And the way to kick it is that these are so-called comb structures. And again, I will show you more detail later. But basically that, you know, these are freestanding structures. These are structures that stand on top of the silicon substrate and that are free to move physically. And, you know, this is a comb structure. It's an interdigitated comb structure, so that when I apply a voltage across these two structures, it has an electrostatic attractive force. And if I would release it, you know, then these are springs that would spring it back. And if I apply an AC voltage across these two structures, then I simply set the physical structures in the vibration, in the physical vibration. And there is, of course, a certain mechanical resonance frequency, which I can hit to obtain the biggest, you know, mechanical vibration for a given voltage input. And when I set this in the vibration, you know, this structure is hooked up to what I call the striker. And this structure would strike against the side of the slider. And these two comb structures are set to resonate, or basically move in sync, so that both of these strikers would strike the side of the slider at the same time. And when it does so, it would give it a kick and it would move, you know, one step in that direction. And these two are for kicking it back and for it to move back. So it is, in a way, that it is a stepping motor of a sort. Obviously the range of motion of this slider is unlimited. Okay. And you can move this back and forth as far as you can, as far as there is slider left. Now the accuracy, the amount of motion per step. Now that is determined by how much force is being delivered by the striker, and at the same time, it's also determined by the friction between the slider and the silicon surface. Now you kick it, it moves, and it's basically purely the frictional force that would stop it, from moving any further. Okay, and as such, there is a certain statistical variations in the size of each step, because the frictional force depends on a lot of initial conditions. So you kick it, and every step will be a little bit different, but on average, we can obtain an average step size and a variation in the step size, and we can design our systems with those kind of statistical knowledge in hand. Okay, so that is our basic actuation mechanism, and that just shows, again, the basic electrostatic comb resonators, and this is a spring. And you apply the voltage across an AC voltage, basically, across the structure, and you set this thing into vibration. And the typical amount of voltage that you would set, that you would need, is like you need a 12.5 volt or 12 volt, around that region of AC voltage. And there's also a DC bias that you would apply, and that's because the reason that you need that is because the electrostatic force is proportional to the square of the voltage. Okay, so if you put an AC voltage, you can amplify the amount of AC force considerably, because of the square relationship. This is an actual picture of the fabricated vibromotor, and these are the comb structures that I have just shown you, and these are the springs that would basically set the vibration back and forth by putting an AC voltage across these two pads. And these are the two strikers that would move the slider in this direction, and to move it backward, we activate these two strikers. Okay. Okay. Now, here we integrate everything together, and we have our, I think this is the best picture to illustrate, down here. that this is our basic slider structure. You know, there's a back slider, and there's a support, and this is a vertical, you know, kind of like the almost vertical, you know, mirror surface, and that is our primary mirror surface. And in our previous, in the previous structure that I have shown, the other slider sits in this direction. Okay, but in order to save space, we actually design this particular structure so that the second slider actually sits under the back support. Okay, so, you know, slider one, slider two, you know, hinges, hinges, hinges. And this slider and that slider can be moved independently. And each of these is being controlled by a set of four vibro motors. You know, these are the comb structures. And so this set of motor drives this slider back and forth, and this set of motor drives that slider back and forth. And in doing so, I can translate and rotate, you know, this particular mirror surface to any place I want. Okay, and okay. Now I would set this in motion and apply voltage onto the vibro motor. And usually the way that we drive this, we do not apply a continuous AC voltage on the vibro motor. No, we apply pulses, a pulse would consist of six AC cycles. And we basically pulse it. And we control the pulse width so that, you know, when you start the AC voltage drive to the vibro motor, it sets the structure into a mechanical vibration. The amplitude will build up, you know, not instantly, but it will take a few cycles for the amplitude to build up. And we would adjust the pulse width so that at the end of that pulse, the amplitude of the vibration has built up to the extent that it actually hits, okay, the side of the slider. So each pulse represents one hit. Right, so, you know, this is the this shows the the different pulses that we apply to the vibro motor, and then we measure the position of the of the slider. And let me show here. And actually, what we're doing here is that we are bouncing a laser beam off the mirror, and we're actually measuring the angular beam position in terms of degrees, okay, of the beam that is bounced off the mirror, and we apply a sequence of electrical pulses to drive the vibro motor, and we measure the beam position. As you can see, basically every time I strike it, it moves one step at a time. Now, the resolution, how much resolution are you getting out of this? Now, there are, as you can see, variations, substantial variations from step to step. And on average, this is for the front slider and this is for the back slider, okay, for the picture that I've shown. It's different because the mechanical design, is a little bit different. Okay, but as you can see, the average step size is about 0.35 micron. It's a fraction of a micron. And the variance, well, this is not a variance, it's sigma. The standard deviation in the step size is about 0.2 micron. So, every time you hit it, on average, it moves by about that amount with a variation of that. And for the rear slider, actually, the step size and the variations are a little bit different. The laser conked out. That's all right. All right, so, in any case, this kind of variations need to be taken into account when you're actually doing the servo control of these devices. The important thing to realize is that the accuracies of a fraction of a micron is possible with this kind of technology. Basically, if you want to hit any particular position, let the beam hit any position with an accuracy bigger than that. This is actually something that is not known in the mechanical world, and for machines, they always have clearance, and therefore there are certain sloppiness in the machines, like in a milling machine, right? Now, how do you control the position of a milling machine? Well, basically you would need to move to the position where you want. It doesn't quite hit it, so you have to move back and forth a little bit until you hit it right. So, with this, you can actually get better accuracy than these numbers if you were to introduce the right amount of control algorithm in your control function, know, so that you will move it and then basically move it back and forth until you hit the right position with the right accuracy. And there was a certain number of steps that, on average, that you need to take to get there. Okay. No, but already, you know, we can, you know, even with this kind of accuracy, fraction of a micron, now that is already quite adequate for doing basic functions like positioning, aligning from lasers to fibers, and for other applications like for a tunable external cavity laser, the kind of accuracy that you demand is higher, like on the order of like 0.2 microns. The indication here is that those numbers are quite achievable, even with the existing level of technology. So as an example, you know, we will fabricate, you know, one of these. This is a what we call a coupling module, and this is actually the silicon substrate, and that's where the laser sits, the laser diode, and this is a piece of optical fiber, and the lens. It's a huge lens. I don't know why it needs to be so huge, but this happens with the lens that we have, and it's a very good lens. And that is our micromirror, you know, that we use to direct the beam from the laser to the fiber. And the coupling efficiency that we measure is a function of the vibromotor steps. Okay, those are the actuator that we actually apply electrical drive to these vibromotors and to drive the mirror back and forth, and that's the kind of coupling efficiency that you get. On this particular run, about 30% coupling into a single mode fiber, which is really quite, it's not the highest, but you know, it's quite respectable. And also that you can see that around the peak, you know, you go back and forth by 5 or 10 steps, well, not quite 10, but maybe, you know, back and forth by about 5 steps, you still pretty much can maintain the coupling efficiency. So what that tells you is that, you know, this kind of control mechanism with the structure that we have is already quite adequate for doing fiber coupling. And you can, of course, attempt to increase the coupling efficiency by, you know, making a smaller fiber lens, for example, or making the optical system more critical. Okay, now, you know, the higher the coupling efficiency, the more critical in the alignment. So if you design it to be more critical, and I think there certainly can be room for designing the system to be more critical than what we are showing here, because the number of steps, the controlling steps of us, you know, it's sufficient. Okay. That I can imagine that coupling efficiencies of about 50%, can be quite routinely done. And what we have here is a package, is a self-contained package that is self-aligned. And every time you turn on the package, you power up the package, it automatically aligns itself. Okay, and it would stay aligned, until the package is powered off. So that's one illustration of, you know, how. We envisioned these micromachines are to be used in optical systems. And you can envision other, you know, possible applications as well. Now, so just one word on how these devices are actually made. I won't go through in detail the processing, you know, steps, because first of all, you know, they actually are quite well established. And second, that's not the main subject of this talk. But the steps that are being used are standard VLSI, sort of process steps. And what you need is, what you see is basically it's a structure built from polysilicon. So what we need is to build up this particular structure, by depositing layers after layers of polysilicon. And after each layer that is being deposited, we would etch them to the appropriate shape. And you also would recall that there are certain moving structures. You know, these structures need to be physically movable from one layer to the other. And so in order for it to move, you need clearance, physical clearance. And to produce a physical clearance, we would deposit during the processing steps layers of oxides, like silicon dioxide, as a spacer. And when all the entire structure is being built up, this wafer is then being etched in HF, which will remove all the oxides. And so everywhere where you had oxides, now you have space. And that's exactly how you free up the structures and to make it into the thing that I have shown you. And for example, this particular structure is a four-layer polysilicon structures. And basically that you have a certain N structures that you want that you want to make, that you have want to make in mind. So you would sit down and basically think about how each of these structures are to be built in their planar form before they are being rotated off after they are being released. And you draw a diagram like this. Now, this is my final structure. And everywhere there is oxide, it's supposed to be space. Everywhere there's space, you put an oxide. And so you will figure out all the etching steps and all the deposition steps for each of the first poly layer, the second poly layer, the third poly layer, and the first and the fourth poly layer, and just carry them through. And the very end step is to etch away all the oxides and release the structure. Now, the number of steps, usually it takes more than 12 masking steps to produce a device like this. And for some of you who have done processing in 3-5 compounds like gallium arsenide to build lasers and that sort of things, I would compare the kind of processing in here as compared to those as at the same time easier and more difficult. Easy in the sense that now you can deposit polysilicon crystals and oxide basically at will, that you do not need to worry about lattice matching, you don't need to worry about defects, electronic defects, that kind of things, as you would worry about in 3-5 compounds. But at the same time, there are more steps, so it's easy for you to screw up at any one time. But on the other hand, these steps are really not different from, not too different from standard VLSI processes. And there are actually foundries out there that specializes in doing these kind of things. You can actually now, without actually having to set up your clean room, you will design all the masks and design all the steps and send it out in a foundry, just like the case of VLSI. And we have also tested the mechanical stability of these kind of structures because that is a cause of concern. You have a plate which is only 2 micron thick and it's extremely small and flimsy, and does it stand any kind of a mechanical vibration? And we have tested, based on the mil-spec, the three-axis random vibration test, and we see no observable motion of the sliders. Once the slider sits in place, we don't glue it, we don't solder it, we don't weld it. It just sits in place and applies this kind of vibrations, and it doesn't move. And at the same time, we apply shock test, 500G shock test. To visualize what is 500G, it is basically equivalent to dropping from tabletop onto a hard concrete floor. That's 500G. And we see basically no observable motion of the sliders. And under 1000G, it starts moving. And that is actually somewhat interesting and perhaps puzzling, but it is not hard to understand eventually, because all of these structures, they are so small, and their masses are actually very light. And the inertial masses are very light. So the motion and what makes them stay in place is actually friction. They are the properties of the surfaces. The surface dominates these kind of structures. Inertia and gravity does not play any significant role in these kind of structures. So since the inertia is so small, you can knock this thing, you can hammer this thing, not on top of it, but you can move this thing around, and it's simply the inertial force is not strong enough to move it around in comparison to the frictional force that makes it stay in place. Now, at the same time, when you do actuation, like the vibromotor, the amount of force that is being delivered is sufficient to overcome the frictional force. Inertial force by themselves really do not play a role. And so these structures are really quite robust in comparison to how they would look. Now, a second, not different, but this is another of the application areas that we have concentrated on, concerns scanners, optical scanners. And this shows a picture of the scanner, and the basic structure is identical to what you have seen. You have a back slider, and that's my back support. But now, instead of just a simple mirror, I now have a door frame that supports this mirror that is hooked up to the door frame through 2 hinges. And so this mirror can basically rotate back and forth across this pair of hinges. And the bottom of the mirror is being hooked up, is being linked to a comb driver similar to the one that I have shown. So, you know, as the comb driver is being activated, it physically vibrates the structure and moves it back and forth in this direction. And in doing so, it would pull the bottom of the mirror back and forth and hence scan the mirror. And we have built a scanner like that to do barcode reading. And we actually have not actually integrated the photodiode on the same chip, but you know, that certainly is a possibility. It's a silicon substrate. It's not too difficult to do. But we have demonstrated this scanning mirror structure together with the laser and actually use it to scan and read barcodes. And in, eventually, if you're ambitious enough, you can imagine that you would have a barcode scanner that you can put on a ring. And these are the kind of things that already, people are using in supermarkets for inventory purposes. And, you have this basically is a scanner that's strapped on your hand and with the computer and so on for doing inventory. And you can imagine that you can put all of these things on a ring. And not like that. Because this picture is courtesy of Chanel. So we will do a modified version of this for a ring scanner, a ring barcode scanner. And actually, we have a project ongoing right now that is even more ambitious than that, is to produce direct retinal scanning head-mounted displays that you would have a scanner. Now you need two scanners for two-dimensional scanning, for the red, green, and blue, LEDs. That you would something that you would mount directly on your head, like wearing a pair of glasses that would directly scan images into your retina. And it's part of an effort in exploring the possibilities of doing scanning displays, versus the more conventional pixel, displays. Now all of this, of course, hinges on the fact that how well this scanner works. And this is actually an illustration of the barcode scanning using our micro scanner, and that's the test structure. And we scan the beam across, and this is the photodetected beam, and which is then threshold detected and reproduced on the original barcode. These are for the two instances. And for the graduate student who never have enough to eat, you always snack in the middle of the night. So this granola bar, with this actual barcode that they use for this particular scanning experiment. And you scan across and get the electrical signal, process it, and basically doing the threshold detection and reconstruct the original barcode. So what this shows is that the kind of scanning mirror that we have produced have the kind of resolution and accuracy that is needed for doing basic barcode scanning. And the these are very tiny mechanical structures, and as such, they actually would work at a very high frequency. The resonance frequency is actually very high, and we are sitting at around, here is like 3 kilohertz or so scanning rate, something that is quite difficult to attain for a conventional bulk mirror. And actually, for barcode reading, the high scanning rate itself is not a positive thing, because the higher the scanning rate, the higher the higher the bandwidth that you need for the detector. You scan across it in a very short time, and there are so many bars that you need to scan, and therefore the signal that is being detected actually requires a higher bandwidth. And that requires, that introduces more noise, and that introduces, the requirements for higher speed detectors and amplifiers and so on. And actually for barcode reading, I would rather have a larger device and have it have a lower scanning frequency. But on the other hand, when you go to actually displays, because there are certain fundamental requirements, like if you want 1,000 by 1,000pixel display, then you need to scan 1,000 lines per second, and you need 33 frames, per second, and you can calculate, what is the resonance frequency, or what is the scanning frequency that you would need to build a satisfactory scanning display, and those would sit in the tens of kilohertz range. So for those applications, you would want the scanning frequency to be higher. And of course, the accuracy itself also would be determined by the quality and as well as the size of the mirror. And there's basic deflection that, for example, the number of resolvable spots per scan as a function of the size of the mirror, and you were sitting at the 200 to 300 the micron range, which is the typical size of the mirror which we built, then you get about approximately 400 to 600 spots per scan. Now, to go to the high resolution display, on the other hand, you will need to build mirrors of a bigger size, which actually is contrary to the requirement that it scans at a higher frequency. So there are some contradictory requirements in here that still has to work out in terms of the technology to realize the actual scanning display. And for that, we're not there yet. And this basically shows the accuracy of the scan. When you scan back and forth, are they reproducible? And this actually shows the position of the laser beam that is being bounced off the mirror on back and forth.